Unbelievably, the world is ignoring one of the most important movements of our time, the struggle for justice, dignity, and freedom unfolding in the heart of Myanmar. The guests we bring on our podcast platform refuse to look away. Instead, they dive deep into the stories that matter, of resilience and resistance, of ordinary people standing up against extraordinary odds. While the headlines may move on, we seek out voices and perspectives that are all too often overlooked. And so we believe that Insight Myanmar is more than just a podcast. It's a platform that seeks truth, connection, and solidarity. And we're glad to have you with us.
Hello, this is E. I'm the host for today's podcast episode for Insight Myanmar. Today we have Augusto Miglet. He is a peace builder here with you. Gus, thank you for joining our podcast today.
Thank you, E. Thank you for having me.
So how did you get started in terms of peace building activism? Because you started the anti-dictatorship movement against since the Ferdinand Marcos Sr. time, right?
Yes, that's true. That's true. Even prior to that, I was a bit active in school, in high school. Got myself involved and engaged in fighting for our rights to have long hair in school. That was my first brush with activism.
How did you start it? It was in Philippines as well?
Yeah, it was in high school, the Philippines at that time. And there was this, required subject of reserve officers training corps or a Philippine military training, part of the subject in high school. And you are required to have a clean-cut haircut to join this course, right? But we were fighting to have our hair untouched. We wanted to be like, we wanted to look like Che Guevara rather than General Patton. So that was my baptism of fire. But it was a long, long time ago.
How did you organize it? Is it just, you know, we will not conform kind of mentality at that time?
We staged a very... in the annals of the history of that high school, I think it was the first and only picket that was held. We walked out of our classes one day, went to the field and harangued the Jesuits who were running the school. And they were all worried, and we were saying that it was our right to have our own haircut. We will be good soldiers even if we have long hair, blah, blah, blah. So they called the police. We were not afraid of them at all. They came, but they had a secret weapon. They called our parents. And so our parents arrived and pulled us back by our ears to the classroom. Hey, go back while you're embarrassing us. So that was the end of our picket and mass action. Of course, I'm exaggerating a bit here, but that's how it was.
That's the activism spirit from the right from the beginning. And how did it transition into you lived many lives before or in parallel to while you're doing activism? You were a journalist before, right?
Yes, well, eventually after college, but in high school and also in college, I was in the student organ, meaning the news organ of the student body. So I was writing, which is part of my, what I love to do is writing, analyzing, etc. And but when martial law was declared by the dictator, that also brought me into conditions and situations where you get to see what's happening around you more beyond the confines of school and your family and neighbors. And that's when you see the atrocities, the human rights violations, the rights of people being run roughshod over. And thus I became involved and engaged with the anti-dictatorship movement broadly, and was tasked and deployed to do different things, different work, and from running a newspaper, being a journalist, being an instructor in university, and being a theater artist, and things like that. Set up a cultural group in school and outside of school, became an organizer, a networker, a coalition builder, if you may. And all of those tasks, and worked at the social justice arm of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of the Philippines. We are a Catholic, mainly a majority Catholic country, and so the church was also, at least parts of it, a major part of it, was also engaged and involved in the anti-dictatorship front. And I was also doing that. So I was crisscrossing around all of those types of work, and then got involved and engaged in what we call international solidarity work, seeking political, moral, financial resource support for the movement from abroad. So that was one of my last tasks for the movement. And so when we won and got Mark was fleeing to Hawaii and he was ousted, we felt it was our moral obligation to share to the world, the rest of the world, our struggle, and for others who were like us, learn from our experience. And that was when we set up our organization to develop this framework of South-South solidarity, wherein we share, as I said, the struggle of the Filipino people, and for others to learn, those in Southern Africa, Latin America, even in Asia. And through learning and exchanges, internships, campaigns, what have you, but eventually we focused in Asia and in Southeast Asia, and particularly at that time in the 90s for East Timor, we accompanied their struggle for self-determination. Set up a coalition called the Asia-Pacific Coalition for East Timor, steered that coalition until Timor became free, where we were a little, small ripple, if you may, or a small drop into the bucket of solidarity that helped them achieve independence. So we were essentially yet a solidarity organization and advocacy network. But in the year 2000, there was an all-out war that was launched by then President Estrada against the Moro Muslim rebels in the south of the Philippines. And our partners in the country were asking us, why are you helping others outside of the Philippines and not people, your friend, your own country, men and women inside the Philippines? Even if our mandate initially, as I mentioned, was to share to the world, the outside, our experience. But even then, we convened and consulted partners. And that was when we, make a long story short, transitioned from solidarity work only to peace building work in the Philippines. So in Mindanao, where that so-called secessionist movement was happening, and there was an all-out war launched against them, in spite of a ceasefire supposedly with them and peace negotiation talks going on, we developed this whole process and advocacy of getting people to be engaged in the peace process too, and not just leave it to the two principal actors, conflict actors, the government and the rebels. So we formed networks that engage this process, and eventually also became part of that movement that made the Muslim minority who were leading this rebellion or this resistance into a political settlement in the year 2000. And so now they are now running this autonomous region in Mindanao, wherein the former rebels are now the government in this region. So that peace-building experience plus the solidarity experience have been meshed. So we bring the solidarity experience to our work in our peace-building work, the same with our peace-building work to our solidarity work. And from East Timor, we went to Burma. Burma was also our advocacy at that time, because at that time, was called for tri-people dialogue. It was at that time, it was for the democracy movement to come into fruition, if you may. So we accompanied that. We also advocated for your democracy, and so for Sri Lanka, for Patan, and other self-determination struggles in the region. Using the nexus of peace building and solidarity in this work. So that's essentially the long and short of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I noticed that you are the co-founder of the Initiatives for International Dialogue, IID, in 1988. So if I get my timeline correct, you founded that and then also helped with the independence of East Timor. And from that, the solidarity movement also trickled into other countries in Southeast Asia, like Myanmar. And so that would be around the earlier coups and the earlier independent movements in Myanmar.
Yeah, that's correct. From the 90s, mid-90s, specifically up to now. So, mm-hmm. I mean, when the coup, attempted coup, happened, we resumed this solidarity advocacy work. But during that 10-year democratic so-called hiatus, we were also there, but in accompaniment, doing more peace-building work among ethnic states and ethnic peoples, trying to help develop that framework of peace building, because at that time, up to now, prior to this unification of your efforts, the different states were also locked in different approaches in dealing with then the Tatmadaw, now the junta, and all of those things.
Yeah. How is that different since you have seen from, decades ago and been through other democracy movement, and also in the region as somebody who has been doing the solidarity and peace building all throughout the years? And with Myanmar, unfortunately, we have this cycles of coup that continue happening, that more efforts need to be put into again and again. So how is this time different from the Damirol that you saw decades ago?
Well, I would say that this time there is even more hope for a more fundamental shift and change in your country, Burma, Myanmar, as your people are the ones taking up the cudgels in the fight in the front lines, and not your elite political leaders leading the way. So I'm very hopeful. And that comes, of course, ironically, with the challenges of a more brutal, brutality from the regime. And even as its supporters also, and the regime, the junta, tries to divide your ranks. But you have been staying the course. And what is also very new here is, of course, the leadership also being passed on, the mantle of leadership being passed on, not only leadership, but the approaches to the young, to the youth, and people who have been in the forefront of your struggle. So it gives me hope, and it gives, I think, a lot of us hope that there would be a more systemic change in the struggle, and also in the in your future. I also see, I think, a more cohesive, coordinated cooperation among the different ethnic, different peoples within Myanmar Burma. And that's also a something to be very hopeful for. So this is the difference, the fundamental difference that I see. And among our ranks in the solidarity movement and friends of yours, we also see that kind of shift among the ranks. So young people taking the cudgels within the solidarity movement, more creative and new ideas coming into the pot, so to speak. And another thing that I also sense and see is that there is a more conscious effort of caring for each other, for the movement, for people, for persons, for individuals, for activists, taking care of each other while struggling and while fighting.
So the in terms of solidarity movement and activities, with your organization IID, what kind of support do you mainly give for organization? How does your organization work in tandem, either with the country like Myanmar, who is actively having some political change, or other countries like Philippines, which has different style and action of change continuing?
Well, as I said earlier, that one of our, I think, one of the things that IID and my organization offers is our track record of networking and coalition building. And so this is something that we stress in the work that we do. We cannot do things alone. We either convene or are part of coordinated work with other groups and kindred partners. In the Philippines, for example, we help establish the Burma Solidarity Philippines, BSP. You know? Prior to that, it was the Free Burma Coalition Philippines. So this is a national solidarity network of Filipinos in support of the struggle of Burma and Myanmar. But we are also, BSP also, and as we are also part of the broader regional and international coalition or movement that discusses, debates, share notes, etc., coordinate campaigns or actions vis-a-vis Myanmar Burma. Apart from that, in IID, specifically as an institution, we do also capacity development, sometimes a long time ago, we initiated a lot of exchange, learning exchange programs, internships of Burmese, especially from the ethnic areas, different coming to the Philippines, learning, being immersed in the work that we're doing, and even with our partners, learning and taking what they can, and also sharing what they can to us, because solidarity is a two-way street. And so that is our, one of also our pillars in the solidarity work that we do, learning and exchange, advocacy campaigns, and joint direct actions have been made. Of course, there's also policy engagement at the UN, at the ASEAN, whatever we think of this, entities, be they slow moving or not, whatever windows that we can tap into each other. And of course, consolidating civil society voices locally, nationally, and regionally, internationally. That is how we do our work. It's the balancing the micro macro. It's doing both local, national, international at the same time. So think and act locally and globally. That is it.
To continue, so the capacity and development, right? Like, so in solidarity, you do capacity building for people-to-people solidarity and also for different communities. From what I've learned, the IID also call for stronger regional solidarity to support refugees and displaced communities as well. Could you tell me more about how this is cultivated? You said with networking and coalition building, that is people to people. But in terms of community, how is it? Is it like, as the organization is based in the Philippines, how do you achieve these kind of network in developing and also empowering people and creating capacity for them to, for the communities as well?
Let me cite to you a particular action that would more or less mirror this my answer to this question. A few months ago, we had a exchange and learning and solidarity visit by some of our Rohingya sisters to the Philippines, in Mindanao in particular, and in Marawi in particular. I don't know if you are aware of what Marawi is. Marawi is the city that was sieged a couple of years ago, 8 or so years ago, and that was up to now, that was displaced all the residents there. It is an Islamic city. It was where a couple of so-called sympathetic groups to the Jamia Islamia held fort and took over the city. But the response of government was to pulverize the entire city, that eventually displaced all the residents up to now. And so a lot of all of them, or most of them, are still living in shelters, and they're in the IDP camps, the internally displaced peoples. And of course, as we've been accompanying this process, because it's part of the autonomous region of the, as I mentioned earlier, of Muslim Mindanao, wherein they are now have this autonomous government of region, but still they're still suffering from this process. Most of the leaders in these IDP camps are women, women leaders, and they are the ones calling the so-called shots in their advocacy, either at the local level for water, sanitation, housing, what have you, and eventually to return back home to their city. So that has been their issues, advocacies, etc. At the same time, this was a particular issue that's linked to the whole issue of women, peace, and security, right? And the need for them to contribute to this discourse, which is being officially developed by government in their WPS National Action Plan, vis-a-vis the 1325 Security Council resolution on women's involvement in peace building, in peace processes. So that was the that was what we were trying to link. And now you have the Rohingya issue also, of course. The diaspora, their own, most of them are in Cox Bazar, what have you. And some of our Rohingya leaders, women leaders, based in Australia, the U.S., and in the region, we brought them to be to have an exchange visit, learning visit in Marawi with the in the camps, have a this interaction with the women leaders of Marawi. They share their stories. They share each other's stories. Marawi women realizing that the Rohingya issue was even more sorrier than theirs. From their, that's their voice. That's their what they said. And the Rohingya women leaders getting inspired by the strength and resilience of the Marawi women leaders, so to speak. And so that exchange went on in Marawi, and they both went to these centers of government in the regional autonomous government in Cotabato, engaged with certain government entities and leaders, seeking for the actions that the IDPs wanted. At the same time, the Rohingya seeking support for their own issues at the policy level of the Bangsamoro government. The same was happened in the, when we brought them to Manila, the seat of central government, to engage with certain congressional and Senate leaders who heard the plight of both the IDPs in Marawi and the Rohingya. And parallel to that, organizing also public forums in the universities in Davao and about the plight of both. And we didn't stop there. We brought them to Jakarta, where the ASEAN was. ASEAN office is based, and interacted with the ASEAN Institute for Peace and Reconciliation, and also the Human Rights Ministry of the newly installed Indonesian government. So this shows you the nexus of each particular issue of the IDP Marawi women, Muslim women, the Rohingya issue, framed in the WPS framework, and engaging the different duty holders at the local, regional, national, and international level. So community actions and community issues being brought to the policy level, and policy actions being brought to the community level. So I don't know if that answers your question or gives you an idea of the things that we do.
And also for Indonesia, in Aceh, there is a large influx of Rohingya refugee ending up there. Indeed. So it is especially important to have these solidarity and interactions between Rohingya communities and other Muslim minority communities that are also facing similar struggles as well.
Indeed. So when we were in Jakarta and we met with the Deputy Minister for Human Rights, the Aceh issue and the Aceh community's response to the Rohingya issue was one of the major agenda points that we talked about and engaged. And so that's some promises from them to look into that situation, etc. But which, of course, now it falls to our hands and the Rohingyas and I to follow through with those promises provided.
I want to go back to your relations with East Timor, Timor-Leste independence. How did you get involved with the independence? And I also noticed that recently you were also awarded highest honor by East Timor in June 2022 from President Jose Ramos Horta. So, you know, your contribution into the country's independence is recognized.
Right. Well, it's a humbling experience. Well, we started our engagement with them in the early 90s. There was this huge gathering of civil society NGOs in Bangkok called the People's Plan for the 21st Century, or PP21. I was there representing IID, and we were very young at the time, 1988, we were just starting. And it was an occasion, an opportunity to network and link up with groups. Okay. One of the workshops in the PP21 was a workshop on Timor and a workshop on Burma. And on Timor, there were a lot of hundreds or so workshops. One small workshop was on the situation of East Timor, where I attended. And Jose Ramos Horta was there. He was a diaspora activist of Timor, going around the world seeking for support. And it was in that workshop that the analysis of, hey, East Timor is in Southeast Asia, but no one in Southeast Asia knows about East Timor. It's only the UN or the Western countries or Japan. Nobody in its own backyard knows what East Timor is all about. And that was when the idea of bringing the East Timor issue back home to the region came about. And so Jose Horta and some of us who were there talked about the possibility of organizing a conference on East Timor and Indonesia. It was first on East Timor and Indonesia in the region. And we were thinking of either Bangkok or Manila, depending on where the proper ingredients would be. And eventually, made the long story, so decided in Manila, in the Philippines, because, well, we had a vibrant civil society, with a free press, we were democratic, and we were also a Christian or Catholic country like East Timor. So there was that resonance of sorts. And we had a willing secretariat, an organizer to be there. That was my organization, IID, to help steer that process. Okay. And so we planned for that conference first. It was called first ICETI, International Conference on East Timor and Indonesia. But eventually, we just decided to focus on Timor. That is why we called it APSET, Asia Pacific Conference on East Timor. It was not about, we didn't, ironically, it upset the generals in Jakarta. So we organized that conference in Manila in 1994. And lo and behold, the General Suharto pressured our own president, former General Ramos, to stop the conference because it was going against ASEAN fraternity, blah, blah, blah. It was intervening in the sovereignty of so-called of Indonesia, because Timor at that time, to them, was their 27th province. To us, it was never part of them. It was occupied and no one recognized them except Australia. Anyway, that's a sidebar. We, because of that pressure, we didn't buckle, and it became a media sensation in the region, even internationally. For 2 weeks running, the Philippine authorities tried to stop the conference. They deported the Nobel laureates who wanted to come into attend our conference. Even the First Lady of France at that time, Danielle Mitterrand, didn't come because of that possibility. Horta couldn't come because he might get deported and so on. A lot who came were deported, some even twice. And at the meantime, some of them were able to sneak in and we were trying to protect them. And it was good that the conference was going to be held at the University of the Philippines, the bastion of academic freedom. And they stood with us. But government also, with a private group, hastily formed private group, went to court to stop us, issued a injunction to stop the conference, but we didn't budge still. We continued and defied the court. The court, under pain of treason, which was punishable by death. And so we were, we could have been, well, punished by that, so to speak.
Yeah.
But we defied that, but at the same time went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court sided with us to continue the conference, but also sided with the president with his powers to deport whoever he thinks needs to be deported. But then we already had people inside Manila, and we protected us. So, but it was a media sensation, and the media was with us. Academe was with us. And the final blow was the Catholic Church, the Cardinal Sin at that time, came out in support of us and in support of Timor, and even saying he was ashamed by what the Philippine government was doing. And so President Ramos couldn't do anything. We did the conference, and because we were basking in that victory, and we tried to push it further, the ones that immigration authorities wanted to deport, we were still trying to protect them, and accompanying them with lawyers going to the immigration offices, with media, etc. And they were saying, stop, the government was telling us to already stop this they even offered us to have it done in Hong Kong, all expenses paid by the Philippine government, and talk about human rights violations even of the Philippines. They did that, and we didn't. I mean, that was not the point. And so the conference happened. We even invited pro-Indonesian participants and gave them space into the conference. To make the long story short, the conference happened, but sensing the opportunity turned the conference into a coalition and set up a coalition for East Timor. So upset, the conference became upset the coalition, the Asia-Pacific Coalition for East Timor. And IID became that secretary of that coalition. And so every 2 years, we had an upset 1, 2, 3. The next upset was in Malaysia, KL, in 96. The same thing happened, Suharto, but that's the same, almost the same thing happened, even more brutal, because they really physically disrupted the first hour of the conference and jailed our Malaysian partners, deported us foreigners from Malaysia. And that was again another media sensation in the region, in the world. And so what we wanted to do initially, of having Timor as an aware, being a Southeast Asia being aware of Timor, maybe just a sidebar or so, became a sensation. And thanks to them, no thanks to them. I mean, thanks and no thanks to them, right?
Yeah.
So Timor, that issue. And so the coalition just didn't do conferences. We organized a lot of different other events, direct events, engagements of the UN, ASEAN, internships also, exchanges. We had Timorese come to us during one of their more deadly conflict times. We had to shelter refugees from Timor, and so on and so forth. So those range of actions that we did for them. And maybe because of that, until they became free and upset, went to Timor and held our two penultimate conferences, 4 and 5, in Timor, and bowed out and transformed it to the Asia-Pacific Solidarity Coalition for other struggles in the region. And I think because of that, we were actually given that medal for upset first in a couple of years ago, before I was given by President Horta as an individual. Mm. It is. So if we run out of money, we're going to pawn it. Teasing. It's, I'm very humbled
more to fuel the cause. What a journey you had in being part of the independence movement. What a journey.
Yeah. And if I may, we're on it just to tap ourselves again a little bit on the back. Because of our work in Mindanao, in the peace process, we were also given by the Moro Islamic Liberation Front a plaque for our peace-building work in, yeah. So we have from Timor, from Mindanao.
Mindanao is where you started, right?
No, well, we started, I mean, our internal, but not yet as IID. IID was outside. But my activism was in Mindanao, but it was more internal. But when IID was established, it was established for others, for outside. Our Mindanao work started only in 2000.
So your past life as journalist, did you have a lot of skills that are transferable in peace building from your past life as a journalist?
I was also a lecturer teaching journalism. And one thing I have told my students is the usual Western framing of journalists should be neutral, should be objective, etc. I tend to disagree. It should be advocate journalism. You always choose a side. Whatever angle you use, that's already choosing a side in writing. So what do I transfer in my work? Of course, the writing for the advocacies that I do, the listening to all sides of the story, whether you agree with them or not. You need to respect and listen to them so you would have a holistic picture of the situation, broader. And also, but at the same time, being anchored into the whose point of view are you advocating for, are you working for? Is it yours or is it the people's? Of course, there are times when majority is not always right. No? Sometimes populism is not right. It's not the good. I remember a Star Wars episode. I don't know if you know what Star Trek episode. I don't know if you know about that. There is this episode when one of these characters, Spock, said to sometimes the needs of one outweigh the needs of the many. So even that, you need to be very sensitive in the work that you're doing. So that also means the minorities, the need of the minority outweighs the need of the majority, especially if they are marginalized, especially if they're in the periphery, if they're along in the corner.
So you started your activism under the Marcos Sr. In Philippines now, there is the leadership under Marcos Jr. How has things changed or how has things remained the same? Like, what is the difference now? And how has your work been impacted by this administration?
Well, of course, they might have the same name, even except the suffix of junior, senior. I think the current son is trying to get out of that legacy of the Marcos Sr., of that infamous legacy of the Marcos Sr., by either trying to twist that narrative that it was the golden age of the Philippines, or showing to the world that a Marcos can also be a human rights defender, if not recognizing these things, and not like his father. But the politics of today in the Philippines is now being bedeviled by a dynasty conflict war. Political elites, the Marcoses and the Dutertes, are just at each other's throats. And, well, it's not just about the Marcoses. In between Marcos Sr. and Marcos Jr., there were others. There was the Jorge Aquino legacy, and her son, Noynoy, also, who was also there. Then you had Ramos, you had Estrada, you had Arroyo. That all of these administrations, even if they were trumpeting to be adhering to democratic principles and all of those things, never really changed the system and changed the fundamentals of the country. And thus, we have to always navigate the spaces that are that we have, the democratic space that we continue to have, thanks to the ouster of Senor Marcos. But there was a time, even without martial law, we felt that there was that space was even shrinking. We continue to push the limits of this space. We continue to engage even the powers that be. And in that engagement, we always bring the voices of our people with a frame of nonviolent political settlement or nonviolent political action, engagement, and getting their voices heard at all this level. It is always a challenge, of course. So far, we do not feel the pressure. We don't feel that pressure compared to the Marcos senior years. That pressure was, of course, because it was martial law. It was a dictatorship. And now, or since the time that he was ousted, you had this pretensions of democracy that they had to show and follow, right? And so we count our blessings and work within those opportunities and windows.
In Southeast Asia, in the same way as there was Marcos Sr. and now we have Marcos Jr., in Cambodia, the Prime Minister Hun Sen, his son, Humanet, succeeded his position. So this rise of unofficial dynasty in Southeast Asia, does it signify an attack on democracy? Or this, like you said, the somewhat of an illusion of democracy that is being shown?
Obviously it is. I mean, obviously it is a trend. Rising authoritarianism, populism, and not only that, but militarization of the bureaucracy is also there with retired military people also in the civilian bureaucracy. Then attendant to that, which is also happening in the country where you are in, is the rise of fascism. This fascist tendencies, right? Not only tendency, but it's no longer a tendency, but it's maybe a practice or a policy even, maybe, or a nature, if I may. So it does. That is why in IID we also have this program of ours. We have three programs. One is building on the peace processes in the region and building dialogues and what have you. We have also transforming the achievements and victories of people's struggles into making people's lives better. But then we have also another program, which is resisting this creeping, not even creeping now, but crawling and running of authoritarianism and militarization in the region. So these are not isolated events. There is a dictator's playbook going around. I think they're learning faster than from each other, rather than sadly civil society is trying to catch up, also having civil society learning from each other also. We've been doing that, but I think we can also take a leaf from how they do it themselves, how they learn from each other. Of course, they have the resources also, and we don't, and they have the muscle and the state machinery to do what they want. And ours is we have the people, hopefully, on our side. But sometimes the people, as you said, because of populism, sometimes are herded into their ranks because of fake news or what have you, social media, hate speech, or what discrimination, it's all of those, the works. And they are able to use these tools in the furtherance of their agenda. We need to use also these tools in countering this, if not only countering, but in forwarding our own agenda or asserting.
In Myanmar, the militarization is becoming more apparent after the 2021 coup and around that time as well. The people of Myanmar were hit by the pandemic and then the coup and then recent and natural disasters as well. And with the series of your connection in the region, how the network and the links, how are the people fighting back the militarization in the region, especially in Southeast Asia?
They are by mobilizing and organizing and creatively also tapping each other's through intergenerational dialogue also. Veteran activists of before sharing good practices and bad practices to the new breed of activists that we have, who are savvier in the new tools that we also are exposed to, so it's organizing, mobilizing, and advocating together, and educating also ourselves from what we can from the past and from what we have today. And I think that is what activists are doing now. I think we need more of this. We need more coordination. We need less, whether we like it or not, competition, especially with regards to shrinking resources also. We need to be very creative also in self-resourcing, in kind and not necessarily in just a hard monetary resource, but the resources of peoples and of ideas, of communities, this we need to harness. And that's something yet we need to do more, I think. But we're getting there. And that's why I see this, I'm very hopeful that we will eventually find that sweet spot of a, wherein the convergence of all of these practices, good practices from the past and the current will be useful for the future that we all want.
In the past decade, the authoritarian regime or leaderships have taken into different forms and has evolved and also started to take it in the form of democracy or more like a soft power, more like instead of such harsh leadership, they have changed into different forms. Do you think activism has also taken into different evolution, because since you've been in this different series of coups and independence, and you have seen a lot in your work, and even before the founding of your organization. So what you have seen as a lifelong peace builder, from what you have seen, did you also see the evolution in activism, or have we been trying to gather solidarity in a different way or in the same way?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that we see new approaches evolving, developing, that needs to be consolidated. But at the same time, we see comfort zones still around, people being comfortable with the old ways of doing things, the old approaches, the old methodologies, the old kinds of actions, etc., the old audiences, etc. But at the same time, we see also the potential for breaking through all of this. You know? That is why it is in our DNA as activists and peace builders to be optimistic, to see this through. Because if you become comfortable, you become more of a professional activist or a career activist rather than activist, peace builder. And that is why this kind of work is, you need to have a mentality of three athletes. One, you have to have the mentality of a marathoner. You're in for the long haul. You're in for a protracted, long marathon. But it's not enough to have that mindset. You also have to be good in obstacle course. During the marathon, you have a lot of obstacle courses that you need to jump up with, and sometimes you hit them and come, have to return, put it up, etc. Yeah. And the third mindset is you have to have a relay mindset. You have to relay the baton, give the baton to this next one at your back, and not expect yourself to be at the end of the finish line of the marathon. The marathon itself is the journey. That's the struggle. But you don't, of course, want to just wallow in the journey. That's why you pass it on to those who will finish the run, the fight. So, and in the process, you learn, and you see new ways of thinking, new ways of caring, new ways of fighting, new ways of struggle, and you test them. Sometimes you fail, you test again, then you find a sweet spot. So you never, as much as possible, you never give up. But then when you never give up, also sometimes you also find yourselves too engrossed on the things that you do. Before you know it, you're burnt out. That's why either you don't pass the baton when you're burnt out. You pass the baton before you become burned out. That's why, while even going through that process, you need to care for yourselves and care for each other. That's something new and more conscious now. Unlike before, we were not conscious of this caring. It's commitment. Go give your lives, whatever. Until everything. The caring was not conscious. It was not. Sometimes you even leave your family behind. Your children are left while you are in the mountains fighting the dictator or something. And your children don't know you at all. And you were fighting for their future, but they themselves don't see themselves in that future that you were fighting for. So,
when you were fighting, helping fight for the independence for Timor, there, you said the media attention, you got a lot of media attention. That was part of the reason the movement became more and more powerful. And with today, there are social media and different kind of media than traditional media now. And how has this impacted in terms of activism and solidarity work? Specifically after the 2021 coup in Myanmar, we see a lot of influx of Gen Z campaigns on social medias, and also different ways of alliances, coalition forming, and also Milk Tea Alliance in the region as well. So how has that form of activism is either fueled or transformed by social media? And how is it different from when you were catching the traditional media's attention?
Okay, just for transparency, we had a project last two or so years on the Milk Tea Alliance, the Milk Tea Wave project. I don't know if you heard. So we were trying to put some sense and order into this very loose network of the Milti Alliance. While it started not for Myanmar only, it was for Hong Kong and all of those things. The last years starting the coup, it was very focused on Myanmar. And IID became the hub of the Milti Alliance network. And we had a Milti Wave project that ended last year. Indeed, there is this new ways of media attention, etc. But it's both good and bad, not bad. It's both a bane and a boon, right? We are able to project, amplify voices of the issues, etc. But at the same time, if we don't do it properly, we get people to become inured about these things. Take a look at Gaza. It's live stream genocide happening, but the world has not done anything really substantial. Ukraine. I had a Instagram post. I'm not in Instagram, but one of my quotes in a recent meeting in Amman was quoted in Instagram, and I was saying, there is a Gaza and Ukraine in Southeast Asia, and it is called Myanmar. And that was an Instagram quote that became viral, of sorts. And so to me, that's reflective of how social media is playing into these issues. It can be very fleeting. Yeah, it can be viral. But how do you harness this viralness into concrete action, policy action? Look just what's happening to Gaza, in Gaza. I mean, it's just abhorrent. Everybody agrees with that, even states, the United Nations. But why can't things happen? Why can't we move things? Because we need to target specific targets that matter. And who are they? This is the United States and Israel itself. But we can also, but how do you do that when your actors are the ones holding these leverages? I think you can chip away and nibble away at the armor of invincibility by massive, massive, sustained, coordinated movement at all levels. Direct actions, social media actions, campaigns, what have you. This has to be some sort of a tsunami type of effect, rippling towards a tsunami. So different ripples from different, but do we wait for a moment, or do we wait for a personality to galvanize us? Do we wait for an issue? We don't. We start now or yesterday in trying to make that moment happen, whatever that moment shape will be. We may not know, but what I know is it will have to be people-led in all the fronts and forms that we can harness. So at that time, during the Timor issue, media was a powerful tool. It amplified things, and it moved policymakers. It moved authorities. It moved the Supreme Court. Maybe it moved the president. It moved legislators, the act. But it, more importantly, it was people. It was the movement of people that the media covered. It was not the other way around. It was not because of media. It was because of what people were doing that the media was there.
Now the people movements are on social media as it happens. And also, like you said, it's the two sides of the coin, or the two sharp edges of the sword. The also Myanmar issue continue to happen. The things that are happening in Myanmar did not stop. But in terms of mainstream media, at least in the Western world of United States and the other countries, we are never short of crisis to cover in the 24-hour news cycle. And the issues tends to get buried down. So the Myanmar coup happened. In the immediate aftermath, there was an influx of coverage on Myanmar issues. And as years went by, then there are more new crises that is just around the corner, like Ukraine and Gaza and Palestine issue. Now it's on U.S. media. The cycle keeps getting renewed. The news cycle is getting shorter and shorter. And also the internal politics of the United States is getting more and more inward facing, I would say. The America first, and also the cutting of the foreign aids, or looking at the humanitarian aid and help to the rest of the world as somewhat unnecessary under this administration. Do you think this kind of narrative, not just the United States, but like some countries in the EU also are looking more and more conservative and more right-wing and more introspective in the way of like our people first, our country first, America first. Do you think that kind of narrative could potentially stunt the solidarity and growth and development for spreading of democracy in Southeast Asia and different regions that your work is based on as well?
That is if that narrative is accepted by the people where that narrative is being sold. For example, that's why the key and the partnership should be with peoples of the United States, peoples of Europe, peoples of whoever. These are the ones who will push back that narrative with their policymakers. It is them who we should align with, and who should we help organize the partnerships and solidarity with. And I'm very hopeful that I don't think the American people would stand for this in the long term, or even the Europeans or what have you. Even eventually, hopefully, even the Israeli people. We do not get enough coverage about how the resistance within Israel is happening against their own policymakers. In fact, that's why maybe they're doing this. The policymakers are doing this to cover or couch that domestic upheaval already happening. Maybe you could also look for champions and allies among states. If they are very good in dividing peoples, we should also learn to divide them, so to speak. I mean, there are, and use their rhetoric, especially the European Union. Its three pillars is development, human rights, and trade, I think. Human rights is one of their pillars. So tap and use that to the hilt. And even if it's just pro forma, I mean, held them to account. And that will, in our own advocacies with the others who don't care about that anymore. So I think it will be hard put for the European Union to abandon those principles. In fact, it might be an opportunity for them to position themselves as a third lateral, a third pillar in the multilateral world now. So these are some of the things, strategies, and tactics that we have to maybe look into how to also, quote unquote, play their game but not be in the game. I mean, learn from what they have been doing, but not use it on ourselves, but use it on them, but not being Machiavellian about it.
And on a closing note, I want to ask you, as you are the lifelong champion of social justice, are you optimistic about the future in search of democracy and this wave of coalitions that are fighting for that.
Of course, as I said, it's in our DNA to be optimistic. We wouldn't be around, not yet still, if I wasn't. In fact, there's no such thing as retiring in this kind of work. You pass on the baton, but you continue to accompany and share what you can. You can transform your role as being in the NGO, be a teacher. I was teaching a long time ago. I'd like to do that again, maybe eventually. I can go back to writing and go back to media and, instead of managing and leading an advocacy organization. I am very hopeful, and the results, for example, of the last midterm elections in the Philippines was also a sign of hope in a way, because of the rivalry of the two dynasties, progressives were able to insert themselves into the winning column. Who were not even part, who didn't even figure in this pre-election surveys. The number one party list that came out is one of the most progressive left democratic socialist parties, who were on the verge of being delisted because they barely made it in the last elections. Now they're number one. And there were two senators from the liberal progressive tradition who were able to make it to the magic 12. One of them was even number two, and the other was number five, when the pre-election survey showed them beneath the 12, magic 12. And a lot of other stories like that. So, and it was propelled by the youth vote, and the youth who were not, accept the narratives being spewed by these dynasties and by this fake news and this flood of AI-generated or troll-generated narratives that just maybe pissed them off, pardon the word, or just they didn't want to buy them anymore. And cut through them and just voted with their hearts. And of course, there were still, the majority were still the representatives of these dynasties, but we count our blessings, so to speak. And I think that's what we need to do. We count every blessing we can and try to multiply those blessings in the work that we're doing.
How can our listeners be a part of this solidarity? Like, if they want to be part of the champion for this democracy and cause of it, how can our listeners participate in this fight?
How are your millions of listeners can I think they would know in their heart what to do. And it's a broad range of possibilities, and depending on their context, where they are, and what they are capable of doing, they can easily write just a simple letters to the editors, letters to their policymakers, congresspersons, etc. Joining a local solidarity group for Myanmar, specifically if there is none, not necessarily about Myanmar, but about a group that works for the disenfranchised and so on. It doesn't have to be, because all issues are engaged and connected and interlinked. We have this saying in Filipino. I'll say it first in my language. Sakit ng kalingkingan ay sakit ng buong katawan, or dama ng buong katawan, which roughly translated is a little wound or scar in your pinky, in your little finger, is felt and by your entire body. And you need your entire body to cure that little wound and scar in your finger. So scars all over the world, scars all over our communities around us, are the same scars of our entire body. The scar of Myanmar, the scar of Gaza, the scar of Ukraine, the scar of Mindanao, of Timor, the scar of immigration policy, victims, a scar of Ivy League students or whatever being iced, if you may. These are scars that we need to see and push back on, engage in, but see also that and realize that these are linked to the entire body. And so when we cure that little scar, particular scar, you are curing the bigger scars, the bigger wound in the body. So specific things, it's for our dear listeners to determine. And from just talking about things like this with your children, your neighbors, engage them in respectful debate if need be, attending what have you, marches, town halls, writing columnists, editors, phoning in suggestions, what have you, sending $1, $2 to advocacies or charities, supporting groups that that are doing other things or bigger things that they can't, that can't be sustained because of the cut in grants and donor support. There's a range of things that one can do.
Thank you for being a part of this conversation and standing in solidarity with the people and the stories shared here. At Insight Myanmar Podcasts, solidarity is not just a word. It's the foundation of everything we do. Each voice we amplify and every story we share represents a call to stand together with those in Myanmar. And so it is through the act of listening, reflecting, and engaging that you become part of this collective effort to uphold dignity, amplify truth, and stand firm for what matters. And I should also add that all of this work is only made possible because of listeners like you who have chosen to offer a contribution. Every donation is an act of standing together, of refusing to turn away, and of reinforcing the bonds that connect us across borders and experiences. If you believe in the power of solidarity and the importance of sharing these stories, we invite you to join us by making a donation. Your support helps us to keep this platform alive and ensure that those voices continue to be heard. Visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to join us in standing with Myanmar. Yarananda, 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 Yarananda,